Please be seated, everybody. Good afternoon. Before we proceed with the oral arguments today, Councilwoman Justice Seda is participating in this panel, but she's on video conference from Carson City, so you'll see her up in the video monitor. And when we do have questions from Carson City, there's about a one-minute lag on the video conference system, so we try to stop for a minute and take a breath so Justice is going to ask questions and all before, so we don't kind of speak over each other. So it's a little bit different procedure, but we'll see how it works through the day. Also, before we proceed with the arguments, I know, Ms. Dickinson, you called and indicated you were going to have some members of your office come over and visit today for the oral argument. Do you want to announce for us who's over here?
Sure.
Well,
you can announce who they are. I think we have some newcomers over here. I'm going to introduce you to
our
welcome.
Thank you. Ms. Coffey, we know, so that's good.
I think you have one other
call. Okay, great. Well, welcome, everybody. And Mr. McDonald is looking at the booth over here.
The superintendent of our own interns.
Okay.
We just started last week, so I'm not fully with all of
them. Well, I think they can stand up and introduce themselves. We'd love to meet you and all.
Hi,
I'm
Mary Campbell. I'm in the DA's office. I'm the recruitment training partner.
Thank you. Okay.
Well,
we're
current intern of the district attorney's office.
That's EJ Axelrod, intern of the district attorney's office.
Kate Williams, another intern.
Stephen Edwin, District Attorney's Office.
Nate Bunn, AJ, District Attorney's Office.
Nate Bunn, Slaughter, District Attorney's Office.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you all for being here. And also, after this argument's done, we have an interesting civil case after that with really good attorneys, too. So if you want to see both sides of civil and criminal, you're welcome to stay for the next case as well, one like that. Okay, with that in mind, with the preliminaries, I know also Justice Seda might have some visitors in Carson City, so if we do, we'll ask her if that happens to introduce our visitors in Carson City as well. Okay, well, we'll call the case. This is case number 58016, Kenneth Shane Simmons versus the state of Nevada. Again, Ms. Dickinson representing the appellant and Mr. McDonald representing the respondent. Okay, Ms. Dickinson, you may proceed with your argument.
I know I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for my brother. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Kenneth Simmons. The Brass versus State case illustrates why a trial court should follow procedures, rules, and statutes that are in place to make sure that a defendant receives due process and a fair trial. Although the Brass case specifically dealt with the Batson issue, the reason the court reversed the conviction in Brass applies here also. Because here, the court did not follow the rules, the procedures, and the statutes in place. In fact, we have pointed out more than 10 errors that occurred in this case, all of which are prejudicial, none of which are, all of which are harmful. The trial began with the trial attorney and the defense attorney discussing how to pick alternates. The judge did not want to follow the statute. NRS 176.061. The trial attorney asked him to do that.
Both trial attorneys?
Both trial attorneys?
Did they ask him to do that, follow the statutory?
He was the prosecutor.
Okay.
I know the defense attorney got into a vivid discussion about it. It's in the transcripts. And the trial court said, no, I'm going to go lottery, a bingo type system, where the parties would not know who the alternate was until they both arrested them in the case. Defense attorney said, well, I don't know how I'm going to use my peremptory challenges.
Didn't the judge just give them an extra peremptory challenge then to make up for that? The equivalent of an alternate challenge?
But the problem is, under the statutes, you select the jury first, the 12 members, and then you use a peremptory for your alternates. So you always know who your alternates are. If you have no idea who has 14 people in the panel, We're clueless. We don't know who's going to be the alternate. It may be somebody you want on the panel. It may be somebody you don't. So, basically, it hinders your ability to use your peremptory challenge, which you have a right to use in this case. It was a life sentence, so it was 8. Not only did the judge do that, he also did not follow procedures for challenging the veneer. Kenneth Simmons was an African-American. This is a 65-person panel. There were only 2 African-Americans on the panel.
Was that record made that there was only 2 members of the veneer that were African-American?
Yes, it was. Normally, the trial judge will ask the parties if they have any objections to the veneer. That didn't happen here. And so the defense attorney approached the bench and said, you know, I have an objection to this veneer. There's only 2 African-Americans. And then she's telling the judge her objection, explaining she'll make it more thoroughly. At a break, the judge says, it's random. So we know that, no matter what she said, he had already decided that issue. It was random selection, and he did not need any more information. The third one...
He didn't discharge the African-American jurors at that time. They went through the selection process, didn't they?
Right, but there was no official challenge to the entire veneer made because he had already decided before she could make a record that there was no problem. It was random selection. Much like the same judge did in the Brass case, we decided the Batson challenge before anybody could make a record. Now, the rule is a little bit different because he could go ahead and make a record later. But the problem is the same, a refusal to file procedures.
Well, I think we understand. Can I go back to the alternate juror? Like, and I had this question. We had this case called Moore versus State. I think the district judge, Douglas, at the time utilized the lottery system, and that was challenged by the defense in picking the alternate. And the Supreme Court panel of Hardesty, Mott, and Gibbons have affirmed district judge Douglas on that case. Why don't you think that case should be controlling here?
Well, here's the difference. In the Moore case, nobody challenged the procedure. And so the Supreme Court said, that's not plain error. It doesn't affect a right. So they did not really win. But they did say that the procedures that were in place under the statute should be followed. The difference here is, in this case, the attorney challenged it immediately. Once she found out there was a robbery-type system, she made an objection. So this is a different type of review than was in the Moore case.
Okay. Now tell me why, assuming we can agree with you, there's a violation of the statute on the alternate selection because it wasn't stipulated to by the parties, would the grounds for reversal, or is it can be considered harmless?
Well, it's not harmless because what it did is it disrupted the random selection process. Under the statutes for selecting a jury, the court system is allowed to use a computer system if it's random. And if you look at the jury's list that's in the appendix, it gives each juror a number. So when they're selected, they're also selected in a specific order. What happened here is, by just using a lottery system and picking a coupon ball out of a jar, you disrupt that random selection. So the question is the system still random? I would suggest it's not. We can show here that the people who ended up being on the jury would have been alternates. In fact, the foreman would have been...
So this is a constitutional basis so that you have a fair and partial jury?
That's correct. And that goes under the Batson challenge where
it's not even getting into the racial issue. Fair and impartial as a fundamental right as to jury selection.
Yes. Yes, that's... You need to have a fair and impartial jury. But you also have
the question
and
is, I guess the question that Justice Williams was getting to, and you can speak for yourself, is there any showing that the jury that has ultimately been selected is not fair and impartial? And should that color our thinking as to this issue?
I don't believe it should color the thinking. That's a very high standard to require us to undertake. I think that if we go back a little further and look at the fair cross section of the U.S. Constitution, where it says the selection must be random, and under our statute it says the computerized system must be random, when the trial court starts taking people out of order, it's no longer random. So I think you can go back to the fair cross section and not look at whether or not, you know, the jury was fair-minded. They've disrupted the cross section, the randomness of it.
Because quite often when we do an analysis, we look to see if there's in fact any prejudice that occurs. And if there's no prejudice, then the question is, at what level should we judge the error if there was in fact error?
Well, the prejudice here was that the attorney did not know how to answer peremptory challenges. Not only did she not know who the alternate was until the end of the case, she had to use peremptory challenges in conjunction with the prosecutor. So the court did two challenges at one time. So she had fewer than 14 people up on the panel when she was making the challenge. And when she objected, the court said, sit down and go with the flow, basically. We have several other issues, and we know I'm running out of time.
Well, there are a lot of issues, and we're interested in a couple of the other ones, too. Perhaps the DNA report, the opening the door issue, and all of some thoughts on that.
And just so that with regard to the DNA, we filed a motion for discovery pre-trial. The state said they gave us all of the discovery. They didn't. The third day of trial, all of a sudden, this new report surfaces. They only bring in an expert to talk about what was found DNA underneath the finger was in the call. They objected. The court initially agreed, but then said, if you open up the door, we'll let it in. I don't believe they ever opened up the door, because to open up the door, it has to be a question that specifically is directed to that, to get an answer. In this case, the witnesses just kind of went off and made some comments about Swabs. I don't think Swabs opens up the door. Moreover, if the court had thought the door was open, he could have given a limited instruction at that point. What resulted is, since he decided to bring in an expert, an unendorsed person who nobody knew, who would show up for court, the trial attorney said, I'll agree to stipulation. So that's what ended up happening. So it was very limited, and the parties agreed not to argue. But it was not fair, because we had filed a motion pre-trial. The state said they gave us all of the evidence. I was going to talk briefly about the video audio, which we objected to the content. The trial attorney wanted more of it shown rather than less. On appeal, I also raised the issue that video audios are an issue of first impression for this court, and I suggest that they should not be used because of the visual impact of seeing a live witness basically testified twice. I hope the court has seen the video audio. They went through all kind of motions and orders to get it to the court, because the trial court initially would not give it to us. But what you see is you see Nicole crying through more than 3 minutes of her testimony. That has a strong impact, and you can see her mother in the background.
Yes, I think it's over the years, as we have advanced, we started with readbacks, we had playbacks, now we have this. Are we to just admit new technology? Are we to prescribe rules or limitations upon it? How would you have the court deal with that in terms of giving guidance?
I would suggest two things. One is that I think we can still use the audio without using the video, so you minimize the impact, even though I'd rather have
the
video.
The jury is in the room. They've heard and they've seen. Why do you limit their senses?
Because you ideally emphasize that part of the testimony. They've only seen the other witnesses or the other part of those witnesses' testimony once, but now there's a select part of direct examination in both Bart and Nicole that they got to see twice. I mean, when I looked at it again yesterday, it has significant impact.
But would you dispute if the court put an artificial limitation on the accuracy of what was presented? Would you not? So if it was going literally, object to that and saying, well, you're not depicting it as it was actually given.
In this case, I would not. because I thought that, you know, showing me the exhibits, showing the knife again, showing the entire jury room, everybody in there, seeing Nicole crying, all of this had significant impact. And not hearing the entire testimony. And clearly, the judge erred by not doing it. And admonishing afterwards, telling the jury that, you know, you can only use this for limited purposes. You're not supposed to just emphasize this testimony. I think that, you know, if I realize I'm running out of time, I want to just briefly speak about the jury conversation with the bailiff, which I think should be reversible error. We don't have a note. We don't know what was said. We found out from the jury foreman after the verdict that they had, there were three for not guilty, the rest for guilty, and they were stuck. And so somehow or another there's a question.
Was that part of the record? Was it reduced?
We filed a motion for a new trial somewhere.
Was that produced by someone testifying in court, or that's just your supposition?
It's an affidavit.
The jurors did not.
It's an affidavit from our attorney who spoke to him, and she made a request for an evidentiary hearing so that that jury, the bailiff, or even the judge could testify. Her request for an evidentiary hearing was denied.
I guess my concern then, and we'll give you a little more time because I know we have a lot of questions. We've had the jurors, you know, people interview jurors afterwards, the judges do, the lawyers do, and I think since I've been on the Supreme Court, I know we've always said that we'll never consider comments made by jurors, you know, absent some sort of fraud or something going on about deliberations and all like that. Is that something that we should really be delving into after the fact of what comments jurors make to attorneys, you know, in post-verdict interviews?
The judge admitted it when we filed a motion for a new trial. He admitted that the bailiff spoke to the jury.
Okay.
He said that, and like I said, I don't know if there's a note of conversation, I'm not sure, because we didn't have an evidentiary hearing. He said that I was going out the door, and he asked me, do I keep him here, or do I want to come back Monday? There was some conversation between the bailiff and the judge, which then went to the jury. So
okay.
You know, there was a conversation.
But there wasn't anything about jury instructions or the substance of the case. It was more about, do they stay later or not, you know,
If we would have had an evidentiary hearing, we would have known what time this question came about, whether it was writing orally. We would have known how much longer after that they made a verdict, they reached a verdict, because according to the foreman, they did a compromise verdict after this conversation. We can see that as compromise based on inconsistent verdicts with count 6 and count 7.
Okay, well, I'll give you an additional 2 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. McDonald, you have 17 minutes to on behalf of the state, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Justices. Counsel, good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to start with the issues that the defense brought up and some of the issues that the court expressed interest in, and then perhaps go back to the beginning if I have time. As far as the communication issue, basically what we have here is a scheduling note. The bailiff asked the judge, you know, what do I do about scheduling? It's Friday afternoon. The judge replied, send him home, have him come back Monday. They reached a verdict that afternoon, so coming back Monday was not an issue. Any of the evidence that she is trying to proffer about, as Justice Douglas said, about what the juror how that actually influenced the internal deliberations of the jury is not admissible. NRS 50.065 specifically prescribes that kind of evidence, and that's why this court has always declined to consider that evidence. All we have other than that is the court's admission that it told its bailiff about this scheduling issue, and we have nothing more. As to the alternates, now, Judge Smith's procedure does not comply with the letter of the statute. The statute requires that extra peremptory be used on an alternate, and Judge Smith's procedure does not permit that peremptory to be used on an alternate. But it does not limit any right of the peremptories because, of course, the defense had their full
the full panoply of peremptory challenges to exercise. So it, to the extent it impinges on anything, it impinges on the right to exercise a peremptory as to an alternate and not a
thing. Yes, assuming we agree with the appellant that this was a violation of the statute, can we review that under a harmless error analysis?
Yes, because when you look to the error, it has to affect some substantive right at trial. And the only plausible right is the Sixth Amendment right to an unbiased jury. And there's no contention that this jury was unbiased. So there's really no effect to the error at all. And it does not affect the structural component of the trial. It does not affect any of the defendant's substantive rights at trial.
Was the extra peremptory provided for the alternates? It was exercised as to the picking of the complete jury?
To the jury in total. And then at the end of trial, Judge Smith had the parties pick a ping pong out of the jar.
So let me get this
right. Those seats.
This was a life sentence case, so there would have been eight regular peremptory challenges on the panel, plus one for the alternates.
Plus two, yeah, one for each side.
Right, one for each side. Yeah. Did the judge give a total of nine to each side?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, and there was a statement, I believe, that they could prove that the jury foreman would have been an alternate or vice versa. Well, that's not the case because, of course, different departments have their secret seats that they use. They all, and Judge Smith as well, they all want to achieve this idea of we're not going to let the alternates know who they are in advance. Mm-hmm. We want the parties to know who the alternates are in advance, but not necessarily the alternates themselves.
Just like, do some judges pick the alternates and announce at the beginning of the case, assuming there's agreement, the alternates will actually be picked before the jury does any deliberation?
They'll say the alternates are seat 6 and 7 or 13 and 4.
Nobody does it where the alternates are actually picked at the end of the case by a lottery method.
That's possible. I don't know about every single department. But I think the goal they want is for everyone to be paying attention for the entire length of the trial. And that's a reasonable one.
Okay. What about this jury veneer issue?
The jury veneer issue, I'm really perplexed as to the relevance of the Brass opinion here. Brass was a Batson issue. I think the only reason why they brought it up is because it's the same judge. The veneer, the Batson challenge goes to an equal protection challenge as to the juror.
I guess, counsel, let's start with the basics, and that is, if the defense has a right to object to the veneer, the question is, did they first object to the veneer?
They did. They said that there were only two African-Americans in the veneer of 65.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the purpose of asserting Brass is whether or not the court at least gave them an opportunity to make an appropriate objection as to was there any basis or was this just kind of a red herring. So that's kind of
what I think the court did, because they asked the defense, what's the systematic exclusion we have here? The defense proffered these things about, the utility lists aren't sufficient and we don't get enough African Americans in the veneer.
Right.
But of course, it's important also recognize that the defendant is only talking about their part of the veneer that composed their possible jury, not the entire pool of selected jurors for that day. So there's kind of a logical fallacy of what I see here is the complete picture. But that is not the complete picture because they're not down in the jury commission room looking at the entire veneer. They're looking at what's in their courtroom. The judge did ask, what's the systematic exclusion? And concluded that defendant was unable to meet their burden, the threshold burden to prove the systematic exclusion of minority groups.
Is that an independent conclusion, or is that a conclusion after at least having the state weigh in on that issue?
I'm actually not sure if the state, off the top of my head, if the state weighed in on the issue.
Is the concern is it supposed to be the judge is a neutral arbiter, so for him to take a position one way or the other before arguments made by both parties pushes us into an area of whether or not there's bias on the part of that neutral arbiter. So that's why I ask that question, is whether did the state weigh in to say, no, we don't think this is prejudicial, we think it's a proper veneer. Or did the court just say, I've heard you, you did the state.
This argument, I know was one of the ones that came in kind of in media res, and it's unclear on the record as to what happened before. I think that our trial deputies contended there wasn't really any, there wasn't really much discussion, substantive discussion, before it kind of bounces up on the record there. And I think, and so everything, the trial deputy said that everything, all of the argument was contained on the record, but it's unclear on the face of the record.
Okay. You want to comment about this opening the door on the DNA issue?
Sure. The DNA came in the middle of trial. We recognized that we could not put it up in our case in chief, but we made sure to bring up with the judge that if the defense wanted to get into any areas, you know, a very common defense tactic is to do the negative inference. Well, you didn't do this investigation, you didn't do this investigation, you didn't do this investigation. Why? To raise questions in the mind of the jury. Knowing that, we said, we told the judge, look, if they get into this area, they're opening the door. And
so what did they do to get into the area?
So they were in cross-examination with the same nurse, mm-hmm. Who testified about all of the different swabbings, and in particular, this was under the fingernails, whatever debris that they took under the fingernails, and she testified that she took a scraping under the fingernails and placed it in the sexual examination kit. The district court intervened and said, careful, you're going to start opening some doors here, and several times warned the defense attorney, you're just about to open the door, don't do it. Defense attorney says, no, I'm good. I think when you hear my question, you'll see it didn't open any doors. The district court, and she proceeded with this, with the scraping, what happened to the scraping, what did you do with the scraping that you took under the fingernails, and later when there was off-the-bench discussion, we said, look, this opens the door. And the judge agreed. The judge said, look, you purposely wanted to skirt to that line, and you went over that line. And the district court made the discretionary decision on the admission of evidence that opened the door. In fact, I think the district court said, counsel, you played court with a roulette and lost. So, are any other particular specific issues you're interested in?
Our last issue Ms. Dickinson talked about was the playback of the video testimony.
Playback. Yeah, in this case, the jury was specifically instructed that they need to be specific. If they ask for a playback of the testimony, they need to be specific as to what they want to hear. And the defense readily agreed, in fact, in one of her affidavits, she said, look, I agree with that they need to be specific about narrowing the testimony that gets played back to them. There's a submitted some kind of a jury request to hear testimony about the knife. And so the defense counsel and the prosecutor and the court recorder go through the direct testimony, specifically of the victim and Barbara Bolt, to see which parts of the testimony comport precisely with the jury's request. Now, up to this point, I think all of us agree. Defense counsel then said, well, I think there's something else there. There was a juror question that had to do with a knife, or there's something else that I want the jury to hear as well. So defense counsel and the court recorder worked together for some period of time and tried to find whatever it is defense counsel was thinking about in her mind. They were unable to find that. And so the portion of the playback that was played for the jury was exactly what the parties agreed to. And as far as the prejudice of seeing testimony that they had already seen again, there are certain cases that appellants cited about readbacks and about how, when they're reading back like a transcript, the reader could actually give unintentional inflection or influence to certain parts of the transcript that was not what occurred at trial. This is an extremely accurate reproduction of exactly what the jury already saw at trial. There are no surprises in there for them. They've seen all of this before. They've seen the demeanor of the witnesses on the stand. They've seen the people in the courtroom. they saw whatever they saw during the actual witness playback.
Okay. Can I ask you about the attorney's fees assessment, the $250 and all like that? Was that properly done by the district court? The district court followed the proper procedure in doing so?
Yeah, I think I addressed that in the supplemental briefing. The assessment fee, basically, it's kind of similar. Well, it's actually even less kind of prejudicial than the Mendoza-Lobos issue, but that's something that, defense counsel really bears the burden of putting on the record.
Yeah, but isn't the court charged with the responsibility of making a determination of the defendant's financial status?
Yes.
And not just say, here, you have to pay X amount of dollars in attorney's fees.
Yeah, by statute, they absolutely are required to do that. Once again, it is simply without any effect on the defendant's trial, the fairness of the defendant's trial. So it's, yes, the district court didn't comply with the letter, but there was no effect.
Mr. McDonald, are you suggesting, because I've heard you narrate it a couple of times, yes, you actually concede the judge didn't follow the statute with regard to the alternate juror issue. The judge didn't follow the statute with respect to the IDF. Imposition or determination of what the amount should be, but it didn't affect anything, so we should just look the other way. What's your guideline for how many times we should acknowledge? I mean, I get the harmless error analysis. I'm not suggesting that we couldn't get around it by doing that, but how many times is it okay for the judge to not follow the letter of the statute and for us to conclude that it did not harm or affect the defendant?
I think you have to look at what the error actually is. Because when you're talking about whether it affects the right, we're talking about the trial rights here, and we're talking about, the fairness of the trial. That's what we seek to protect. If you have several errors that affect substantive, a completely incorrect statement of the law on a first-degree murder charge, and significant prosecutorial misconduct, then you have lots of errors that actually affect the fairness of the trial. If you're talking about whether defendant can afford $100 to the indigent defense fund, or $250, or maybe nothing at all, and once again, I put it in the supplemental briefing, he has recourse.
Why should he have to go to the recourse when there's a rule up front as to how the court is supposed to do it?
And my response would be,
why don't we just step over the rules, like they don't apply? We just cavalierly say, well, they have recourse, screw the rules, we'll do this anyway.
I don't think we're screwing the rules. I think the responsibility, I would submit the responsibility lies with defendant's counsel. And defendant's counsel needs to be the one to speak up. That is their role. They're there to counsel the court as to what the law is. And if they remain silent, then some of the responsibility falls on that party.
Okay. Let me ask you one other thing, too. And this is kind of a follow-up of what Justice Savis said. I'm sorry, Justice Savis, did you have another question?
I was just going to follow. Thank you, Justice Givens. I was just going to follow up by saying I don't debate that the imposition of the $250 and potentially the obligation that an attorney might have to raise that to the judge. But I'm really concerned about what I keep hearing is a cavalier attitude with respect to the rules. That's where I was with my first question. I think that there's a possibility that this whole alternate juror issue is enough for me to consider whether or not there was some error that truly affects the defendant's rights. And then I add to it this other little violation of the rules. I mean, I don't want to use that term slippery slope, but I'm going to. Where do you stop collecting? And I am not ignoring the fact that there's a harmless error analysis that we can go through. Please don't hear me saying that. I just, I really am offended by this. It's a violation of the rule, but it's okay. Because I also, neither of you have touched on it, but there's a couple of jury instructions at issue here that really were questions of whether or not they were accurate or not. We haven't gotten to that, so I'm wondering how that would be analyzed as well. And I know that's a verbose question. Sorry, Justice Ginsburg.
Yeah, and
I have a lot to say, but
we'll give you a chance to say it, because I kind of have the same concerns, I suspect, Justice Douglas does too. Basically, this is our concern, again, for all the young attorneys who are attending. A lot of times when we look at these appeals that I've seen, we go through a whole panoply of issues, and you know, there's an error here, there's an error there, an error there, and we go through this harmless error analysis, but at the end, it's kind of like the straw on the camel's back. When do they pile up, and you say, okay, maybe there's too much here, and that's why we have to reverse, you know, like that. And you used to work for the Supreme Court. I know you
have a lot of experiences very, very well
in this area, so tell us about the cumulative error standard. What should we be looking at, and specifically in this case as well?
I think you have to look at accumulating errors that affect the fairness of the defendant's trial. Mm-hmm. I think we can exclude the $250 indigent defense fee. Okay, there is some degree of error as to the alternate juror selection. When I first read this, it definitely spoke to me. But once again, the effect of that error is very limited because there's no constitutional right affected. All it affected was the ability to exercise a peremptory as to an alternate. It didn't even affect the rights to peremptory. They weren't deprived of any statutory peremptories. So I think that is one very small error that we have here. And you
don't feel that the opening the door issue was error? You've already explained your position on that. But
no, I think that's clearly a discretionary move on the part of those.
Let's say we disagreed with you on that. I mean, just, I don't know if we will or not, but just for the sake of argument, if we disagreed with you on that, should that be considered harmless?
Because the defense theory at trial was consent. You know, there's no, the fact that they found the defendant's DNA on her is really of no moment. It would not have affected the outcome of the trial.
So you're saying it was sexual activity?
Well, yes, either way. They offered a consent.
So the question would be then, is it consensual or not, then, like that?
And the judge recognized that as well. He said, well, look, I know you crossed this line, but, you know, the prejudice to you is because you're proffering a consent defense.
Okay.
Now, there are jury instruction issues. I don't know if I have time to get into that.
Why don't you go ahead and give Ms. Dickinson a little more time, too, so go ahead and address them.
Okay, I'd like to, unless you have other ones you'd like to
know. No, I think
specifically, Instruction 34 and Instruction 12. Instruction 12 is the complete sexual assault instruction based on the statute that includes the component of knowledge that the victim was unable to consent. Okay, so this was a jury instruction that was accepted by the defense. Okay, there was no evidence that the victim was unable to consent or knowledge or anything. There was no evidence of that at all. But the defense had a strategy. Okay, so they accepted this instruction, and then they wanted a voluntary intoxication instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Voluntary intoxication negates specific intent. Okay, they got that. The next piece in the puzzle was Instruction 34, and that was became 34. And what the defense did is they wanted an instruction that included language from this Kansas case that if you have sexual assault with the element of knowledge of the victim's inability to consent, that kind of sexual assault, even though sexual assault is a general intent crime, becomes a specific intent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the district court denied that instruction. So if they had gotten all of the instructions they wanted, even though there was zero evidence of inability to consent, they would have had a voluntary intoxication, they would have had a inability to consent with specific intent, and they would have had the entire sexual assault strike.
Okay, I think we understand.
Okay.
Any questions from Justice Douglas or Justice Seda on that? For Mr. McDonald. Okay, thank you, Mr. McDonald. Yeah, please, could you give Ms. Dickinson an additional 2 minutes? It would be a total of 4.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning with the
issue with regard to the scheduling note and when the state argued that jury's comments were not admissible. You know, we asked for an evidentiary hearing. We could have had the comments from the bailiff. NRS 175.301 governs what the bailiff can say and what he can't. Bailiff is not allowed to speak to the jurors unless the court directs him. Obviously, the bailiff spoke to the jurors, otherwise he wouldn't have asked the judge a question. So clearly, that was a violation. With regard to the alternate, it's a structural error. It's not harmless. You know, it's true that some of the judges have secret seats, but everybody knows in advance. And it's also true that some judges follow the letter of the law. Alternates now are alternates. But hiding it from everyone, meaning the defense attorneys and the prosecutor, is something that's not usually done. With regard to the veneer, the state did not object when the defense attorney made a challenge. When she made a challenge at the bench. Later on, she went to make a record. State did not respond at all. The court again told her, second time, it's random selection. So there was really no discussion about the three requirements of a Williams case. With regard to the DNA, they suggest there's some sort of tactical advantage. We can make negative inferences. This was consent. I mean, she claimed it was violent. So when I'm producing evidence that there's something underneath her fingernails, that clearly is prejudicial. The defense attorney made a wonderful record starting on page 971 of the appendix, where she says, I didn't ask the detective about DNA being tested. I purposely did not ask. They introduced a picture of a hand. They introduced and asked a lot of questions. She had a line of cross-examination to kind of skip around that, and she did. She did not open up the door. With regard to the jury instructions, the state suggests that somehow we claim this law. So that's not in the record. There's nothing in the record to indicate that we asked for jury instruction number 12. More likely, we didn't even realize that it was different than the information, that he wasn't charged with the second theory. That we did offer the other instruction for specific intent, but there is simply nothing in the record suggesting we asked for this instruction. These are the state's instructions. The state usually gets what they want needed in this case. Now, with regard to the sentencing, over and over I hear the state suggesting that happens at sentencing, not plain air. Well, I suggest that they look at the U.S. Supreme Court case of Puckett at 556 U.S. 129. Plain air applies at sentencing. So if a judge does something wrong with sentencing, it can be reviewed. There's two things this judge did wrong. With regard to
the... Mr. McDonald was saying it didn't apply to cumulative error on the $250. This is what was supposed to plain error. What's your thoughts on that?
Okay, I think that that based on all the problems with the jury selection, the evidence, the court keeping out the pictures of the tattoos and pictures of the defendant, and trying to, and allowing the state basically to get the DNA evidence, he wasn't given a fair trial at all. But with regard to the sentencing, he wasn't given a fair sentencing either. So it's a pattern that keeps existing. And the Indigent Defense Fund was established under strict guidelines to make sure that it wasn't abused, because we don't want defendants to feel like, oh, gee, I should probably plead guilty, or I'm going to have to pay for an attorney. And if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court case that I cited, when the Supreme Court reviewed another state's Indigent Defense Fund statute, they noted that there were strict guidelines in place that would not allow the state to assess a fee, and that later on the defendant could come in. Under the Truesdale ruling, we can assess a fee without doing any of the requirements of statute, and I suggest that makes it unconstitutional.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dickinson. Thank you all for your excellent arguments and briefs.